cual. United States Tourism International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Gary F. presiding before court number 21-00565. Captain Demir et al. Versus the United States et al. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiff?
Andrew Schultz for Grandpa Does It Ariel, representing Captain Demir.
Morning.
Morning.
So Sun Bay from DOJ for the defendant, the United States, and with me is Mitch Purdy from Department of Commerce.
Morning.
Maureen Thorson from Wiley-Ryan here on behalf of the defendant intervener, the Rebar Trade Action Coalition.
Morning. Please be seated. Welcome. We're here in this civil case challenging Commerce's final determination in the CVD Administrative Review of Sealed Concrete Reinforcing Bar from the Republic of Turkey. And the plaintiffs dispute Commerce's findings that the Kapton affiliate NUR was a cross-zone input supplier and that NUR's rent-free land with regionally specific benefit conferred the provision of a good for LPAR. They further argue that Commerce's industrial rent benchmark selection was not supported by substantial evidence. Of course, there are other arguments that are made. There are responses to the arguments, but both by the government and the defendant intervener. The parties have responded to the government's, excuse me, the court's questions for oral argument that were submitted on January 9th. The court also issued on January 20th a few supplementary questions that did not require a written response, but we thought that since Nucor would figure importantly in the analysis, it was helpful to focus on further questions, including those regarding the relatively recent Nucor decision of October 2022. The parties understand that the time allocations, you've been in touch with Mr. Gold, each side will get 30 minutes, and the defendant and defendant intervener will be splitting up your 30 minutes. I think it's helpful to use the time as an opportunity to rebut the responses provided by counsel. Opposing counsel to the January 9th questions, but also, of course, to address the more recent questions. You have, if you wish, if you want to take a couple minutes and by way of an opening statement, you can, but that's up to you. So without further ado, we'll hear from Mr. Schultz. And the plaintiff intervener, we've been informed, will not be appearing in this argument.
Right. Cool. Okay. I'm ready. If you're ready.
Yes.
All right. Great.
May it please the court, Andy Schultz from Grenfell Does It Ariel again, representing Captain Demir. It's good to be in person. It's my first in-person argument since the pandemic. While I miss my dog at my feet, it's nice to be before the court.
Well, welcome. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, so I was just going to do a real short little opening and then turn to your honors supplemental questions and some rebuttal points.
Great.
So, in a number of the questions, the court was asking the best support and the precedent for our various positions. And I was really thinking about that as I was preparing for this more. And something was really kind of gnawing at me. And what it was is that, you know, our position is really that the facts, the simple facts of each issue are really the most powerful support. And when you look, distill each of the three issues to their most basic facts and then compare it to what Commerce did, something is just very wrong. So just quickly looking at each of the issues, you have cross-ownership. You have NER, which is producing these highly complex, sophisticated ships and vessels, which are probably, it's probably not an exaggeration to say, thousands of times more expensive than these commodity products that Captan is producing. And they're intermittently selling minuscule amounts of scrap, 0.05% of their sales. That doesn't sound like part of a vertically integrated production that the parties have been arguing about. That doesn't sound like that NER is merely a link in the production process of Captan. When you look at the revenue foregone, similarly kind of simple issue. NER has a contract with the local government to use land for free as long as they follow certain conditions. This is pursuant to law 5084. If the criteria aren't met, then the amount of money owed is listed in the contract. And that provision says that it is an annual easement fee and it provides what that should be. So the contract shows what the government fee would be owed. Why are we looking for a benchmark? Why is the government and petitioners coming up with all sorts of novel ways to get outside of the contract? They're saying it's not a lease. It's a conditional easement. The fee's a penalty. It's not a clear price term. It's not a standard amount. Frankly, these are all red herrings, and it's just wrong. Revenue foregone is one of the most basic types of subsidy programs. It's money owed to the government that you don't have to pay. That is the exact description of the facts for this issue. It really is not more complicated than that. There's a clear fee outlined in Article 16 of the contract. It's labeled as an annual easement fee, and NER doesn't have to pay it. That's the exemption. That's the benefit. That's the issue. And then lastly, you have the benchmark. The local government, as I said, let NER use this land for a period of 49 years. Commerce selects a benchmark that includes, that is a monthly rental per square meter price that includes land and buildings. That is not an apples to apples comparison. It is undeniably distortive to compare land only to a land and rental, or sorry, a land and building benchmark. So when you look at each of these issues in these simple manners, Commerce's determination for each just does not make sense. So I'd like to turn, if it's all right with Your Honor, straight to your supplemental questions.
Sure.
If that works. Okay. So your questions all relate to Nucor. And the first question you asked is, in your opinion, is Nucor distinguishable, and should the court consider Nucor in its analysis? I think that Nucor is actually very helpful from a legal point of view for this case. There are a couple of distinguishing facts, which are a little bit different than the underlying case in there is a little bit different than ours. It has this indirect sales issue, and the quantity issues seem to be some sort of post hoc reasoning for Commerce. But I don't think that those facts make the case distinguishable for Your Honor's point of view and how to look at this case. I think there's a couple of different things we can glean from it. Well, certainly we agree with Commerce's underlying decision in that case in the way that they analyzed this provision that we're arguing about. But I think that Chief Judge Barnett understandably recognizes that Commerce has made conflicting decisions regarding the primarily dedicated analysis in this regulation. I mean, frankly, and I think Your Honor has also recognized that based on your questions, I mean, Commerce has kind of been all over the map. Some cases are doing a very detailed analysis, taking nature of production and other things into account. Some cases are doing a very cursory analysis, not really looking at anything other than, is this an input used for subject merchandise, and are you selling all or most of your inputs to the respondent? Clearly, you can't be both of those things. Commerce has to have a set of criteria or a consistent way of looking at this. And if they don't, that would be arbitrary, and it requires a remand, which is what Judge Barnett required in that case. And I think the other thing notable about that case is the fact that both petitioners in that case and Judge Barnett relied on what happened in the case that's challenged here. And Commerce is finding in this case that the nature and the primary business activity of the affiliated company doesn't matter. But that's obviously not true in the sense that there are many other cases where Commerce has taken that into account. So I think that if Judge Barnett is remanding his case, since this case is connected to that case in that sense, that this case also requires a remand so Commerce can at least have a unified decision on how they're looking at this issue.
Now, of course, we've read your filings.
Yeah.
If, in fact, the court does remand on the question of whether Kroger was a cross-owned input supplier, do we need to address the other issues posed by your filings at this time?
I mean, you could theoretically hold off on issuing a decision on those other issues because everything flows from that. So if Commerce were to find that NER was not a cross-owned supplier, then these other issues are moot. They don't matter anymore because the subsidy would not be attributed to CAPTAN and that's because of that. I think that for expediency, it might be beneficial to have Commerce or to address those issues and have Commerce do it, or else, you know, these things can take a very long time then if Commerce doesn't make the decision. And then we have to decide it again, have an argument again about the issues, or Your Honor has to make another decision and send it back.
There's another CAPTAN case.
That's right. Yeah, you're right. We have the very next review, mm-hmm. which is currently on appeal, which we have our opening brief due soon. And it's an identical issue. So theoretically, those cases, I mean, they're getting close to the same track. They could potentially be decided. Mm-hmm. Almost at the same time.
Thank you, counsel. Please.
Yeah.
Proceed.
Okay. Okay. So your second question relates to really the differences in different lines of cases. And you asked about a number of the cases that defendant interveners identified in their response. So as I looked at those cases, it looked like there are about three cases. And this is kind of what I was mentioning in regards to the first question, which is, you know, in really these three questions, in these three cases, Commerce really didn't go into the issue. You have this ICDASH case where the sole issue seemed to be quantity and how little was being sold to the respondent. There really was not a discussion in that case, it seemed to me, about the nature of the production or the primary business activity or any of the byproduct nature, any of these things really regarding the input supplier.
Well, what's your view of the analysis in ICDAS?
I think that...
I won't take it personally.
Yeah. Look, I think that I think the quantity is a factor to be taken into account. I think that there has to be a more holistic view of it, and I think that you have to take into account these other things and not just the quantity. I think that there are scenarios where, you know, to be completely fair, there are certainly scenarios where very low quantities can result in a cross-ownership finding. I don't have really that big of an issue with that, but I think you have to take it into account with the other issues here. And our other issues are not just our issue is not just quantity. That's one of a number of different ones. And so then when you look at the other two cases, Rebar and OCTG, it looked like nobody really briefed these issues. So the issues were not raised. So the distinction is not that clear. And I think that's really the big problem with how Commerce has done its analysis under this provision. You have some of these cases that are totally cursory. They're not really looking at that much. They're only looking at, okay, is this an input? Yes, they use it. Yes, they sell it. Done. But then you look at other cases, as we mentioned, like the FEB's case, glass containers, a number of the Korean cases, including, you know, that we attached that memo that they put to, they put in the bottom mount refrigerators case. We attached it to our response. I mean, Commerce goes into an extremely detailed analysis about the nature of each company, each input supplier, how much they're selling, what is the product, what else are they doing. I'm not sure how that can be reconciled with what Commerce has been doing in these rebar cases. And if you look at the preamble in particular, you know, those detailed analyses make sense. That kind of follows what the preamble is talking about. When you look at the cursory cases, it's really not following what the preamble could be. And I'm not really sure why Commerce is doing different things in different cases, to be frank. It's really the way I would call it is kind of a split in the circuit, right? They could have different teams or different offices that are look at this provision in different ways. I don't know. I'm just speculating, of course, but there obviously is some sort of split in how, this provision is doing.
And the great thing about all this being in one place.
What's that?
We can easily ask a counsel the question about, whether there's different approaches are a reflection of different structural reviews.
I can tell you just from personal experience, there's been lots of issues where I've had different cases with different teams, and they treat things differently sometimes. And sometimes you need the court to help Commerce kind of resolve and make a clearer analysis.
They treat things differently where the basic facts are the same.
Yeah.
In your view.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that's, you know, I think that then which goes to really your last question, you know, which is there, look, you have two different ways of commerce is doing things two different ways. And that's the exact definition of arbitrary. And I think that it's, you know, Judge Barnett was correct in that assessment. And I think that when you have these situations, you know, it's up to the court to send it back and try to get them to resolve it. You know, particularly an issue like that. I mean, this is a really important issue, actually, just from a practical standpoint in terms of respondents doing cases. You know, it goes to whether or not when I'm doing a case, a respondent needs to report subsidies of their affiliates. And if you don't do that and there's no kind of clear way of identifying those affiliates, that's not very fair. And you can get in real trouble if you don't identify those affiliates properly because you thought you were following Commerce in one way of the way Commerce was doing it, not the other way. Okay. So I think what I'll do then is I'm not going to go through each question that they did. Mm-hmm. I was kind of going to group a couple of the issues together.
Okay.
If that works, and honestly, happy to answer any other questions you have. But there were a couple of different points I wanted to hit. The first, there were a number of questions that related to the generation of scrap and production and the byproduct nature of scrap and whether that is important or not. In our view is, of course, that the fact that scrap is only inadvertently generated and the nature of it as a byproduct has to be important to Commerce's analysis for a couple of reasons. One, you know, a company cannot set out to make scrap. A producer can't, and really no reasonable person would purposely try to make scrap. In fact, you try to make as little scrap as possible. In addition, the only way you can make scrap is if you are producing a higher value product that is of higher value than the scrap. Here, of course, you have ships and vessels which are exponentially of a higher value add than rebar or commodity steel. So when the preamble is talking about a lower value input going into a higher value product and the production of that lower value input, it doesn't really mesh with that discussion. The other thing that is an important nature of scrap, I think, is that it's not really consistently produced. You know, like here you have it intermittently kept, NUR is producing scrap that is being sold. You know, it's not like if you just compare it to what Captain is doing with their products, like they're not only sometimes producing rebar. Like their products, they're trying to produce as much as possible of those products to sell. That really is not kind of the nature of scrap. And I think it's important because when you kind of take a step back and you look at the theoretical purpose of this provision in the law, it is a really hypothetical government subsidizing the input production for the value of to assist the downstream product. And you can't really identify who produces scrap or not. I mean, it's a byproduct, and even if you look at a company's financial, I looked in this case and you couldn't really tell, but under normal cases, most companies don't even include scrap in their normal revenue. It's usually an other income item. It's really an ancillary thing. It's not something that you can tell that a producer is making. So I think at the end of the day, what this does is that, you know, it is a factor to consider, and it is a factor that makes other factors potentially less important. So here, the important things from Commerce's point of view and the government's point of view is that they sold all the scrap to NUR, or sorry, NUR sold all the scrap to Captain, and that this product is used for the production of subject merchandise and other merchandise. Yes, those are, of course, relevant factors. But when you look at the nature of the scrap and NUR's production and et cetera, that, in our view, is a much more important criteria or factor. Then just quickly looking at revenue foregone, and then I'm going to reserve some of my time. But in looking at petitioners and the government's responses to Your Honor's questions, this whole issue really boils down to one thing, which is what does Article 16 of the land contract mean? And just to remind Your Honor that the name of that provision in the contract is the conversion of the free of charge right to use the conversion of the free of charge right to use to the right to use for charge. And everybody seems to agree that if the contract properly identified the fee, that would be revenue foregone. And the government, in fact, states, and this is quoted from their response, that when calculating the revenue foregone, Commerce requires a clear price term or similarly defined method to determine the amount of financial contribution at issue. So where we start to diverge is, why doesn't Article 16 do that? We think it does. They say it's a penalty, but this provision is clearly labeled as an annual easement fee. A penalty, in my view, would suggest that you would be forfeiting the land or something, or at very least would likely say it's a penalty. They say it's not a clear price. Our view is it's not clear. There's a clear method of calculation in this provision. The total amount of value is identified in the contract, and this provision identifies a percentage of that value as the fee. A percentage is a very clear item. It is not different than, say, exempting a tax, which is always a percentage, or exempting import duties, which are also percentages. The fact that it doesn't identify the actual amount in terms of a number is not dispositive. And then they also mention this phrase a couple times, that it's not a self-defined standard rate. I'm not sure what that is. There's nowhere in the law or in practice where that term has been used in this context. And then most importantly, the contract really follows the law. And, you know, this whole subsidy follows from what is the law. What does the law say? The law says you get an exemption to use the land for free. You get exemption from paying to use the land, and so you get to use the land for free if you make these investments. So it's an exemption, and that's what the contract provides.
I just want to be clear in my own mind. Are you disputing, is there any dispute here that ultimately a cap available subsidy exists?
Correct.
Right. Is there a dispute?
There is not a dispute.
So the choice is between two definitions?
Correct.
And why isn't that choice meaningless if it does not create actual differences in the outcome?
Well, it creates actual differences in the sense that it impacts how the benefit is calculated.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have in our direct brief, it shows how the benefit would be calculated under revenue foregone and how the benefit would be calculated under the LTAR provisions, and it's wildly different. So that's why it matters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's all I have, actually. I'd like to reserve the rest for a rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Yep, thank you.
Hear from counsel for the government.
May it please the court. I'm going to follow roughly the same pattern Mr. Schutz did, starting with just a few introductory overarching points and then moving to Your Honor's supplemental questions, and then finally doing a little bit of rebuttal on plaintiff's written answers. Of course, there's a lot of kind of bleed through between those, so I'll try my best to avoid being duplicative. I think the first thing I want to say is that we agree with Mr. Schutz that the simple facts of each issue dictate the outcome. But what we think is that plaintiff misconstrues what those facts are or what is important. Starting with the cross-owned input supplier issue, Commerce has made clear, and we've reiterated throughout this entire proceeding, that this issue is extremely fact and case specific. And here, Commerce explains specifically in its IDM that NERA produced the scrap. Captain is the primary and sole user of NERA scrap, and NUR exclusively produces and provides that scrap to CapDen as part of CapDen's overall downstream steel production chain. And those are the key facts on the record that supported a finding that the production of scrap was primarily dedicated to CapDen's production of downstream products. Now, Mr. Schutz, and I think Your Honor, have put some focus on the varying outcomes in different commerce proceedings, and I know this goes a little bit into your supplemental questions, but I think what's important here is that while it may seem like there's contradictory positions by commerce, the facts of each case are different. There may be some facts similar between various proceedings, but it doesn't mean that the exact facts of each proceeding are the same, and Commerce must look at the entirety of the record in each case. So we don't think it's necessarily that Commerce is inconsistent, but rather that the facts of each case are different. And so we urge Your Honor to concentrate more on the facts of this case and the facts of the input of scrap production rather than comparing to other cases. Having said that, we do think that to the extent Your Honor looks at other cases, your prior decision in ICTAS should be the decision that most guides the outcome in this case, and that's because plaintiff has not sufficiently distinguished why the court should come out differently in ICTAS in terms of factual distinctions or anything like that. To the extent we're talking about the other issue about the land for LTAR, I think that one comes down to the fact of whether the amount that's put forth in the agreement is a rental rate or a penalty fee. And we think it's clear from the record, and we think that Commerce's decision that it's a penalty fee rather than a rental term is completely reasonable and supported by the record. If you look at Article 16, it says that the penalty amount is 5 per thousand of the current year project cost of the investment, which Commerce takes to mean that it's five per thousand of the amount that NUR is behind on its investment goal. So say the investment was $1 million. I'm just throwing hypothetical numbers out there, and NUR had $900,000, then it would be five parts per that one per thousand of that $100,000. And so I think the fact that it's clearly lower than what a rental fee would be, aka the amount that NUR would otherwise have to pay to rent that land for the purpose, and the fact that it's such a sliding scale makes it clear that it's not a rental term. I don't know about anyone else in this room, but I've never seen a rental term that's, you know, X percent of some variable amount. And I think that it's clear that this amount is a penalty that basically increases the further behind that NUR is on its investment. Now, one more point before moving to Your Honor's supplemental questions, and that's the CVD preamble. Plaintiff obviously focuses very hard on the preamble, but we think that they make a clear misconstruction of one of the main parts of the preamble that they rely on. They take the statement, subsidy is provided to an input producer whose production is dedicated almost exclusively to the production of a higher value-added product. And they assume that that means the whose production is dedicated means that they're talking about the company's entire production being dedicated. But you have to read that in the context of the preamble and the context of the regulation. You can't just read it in a vacuum. And I think the very next sentence in the preamble mirrors the language in the regulation, which says specifically when the production of the input product is primarily dedicated to the production of the downstream product. That makes crystal clear. And here we're talking about the language of the regulation, which is the first and foremost guidance that Commerce has to go with, that the production of the input product, here scrap, is what Commerce really is supposed to focus on and what the court should focus on, not NUR's business as being a shipbuilder. Turning to Your Honor's supplemental questions, the first question is, your submission appears to be that Nucor is distinguishable from the case at bar. Domestics, however, appear to argue that Nucor is helpful in assessing Capdan's arguments. In your opinion, is Nucor distinguishable and should the court consider it in its analysis? Of course, Nucor is not harmful to our case here, but as we've maintained, and as I said a few minutes ago, due to the nuanced and fact-specific nature of the analysis, Commerce, of course, reviews the facts of each record case by case, and each decision is highly record-dependent, and the facts at issue in Nucor are quite different from the facts here, and Commerce did explain, or we did explain this in our brief. Specifically here, there's a clear vertically integrated scrap supply process where NUR makes the scrap, NUR sells all of its scrap to Capdan. Capdan uses that in its downstream steel production. In the CTL plate proceeding, which is the subject of Nucor and in, on which plaintiff heavily relies, there is evidence that The Crossland input supplier issue did not provide or sell the scrap directly to the respondent company, but rather to a reseller. Moreover, there's no evidence on the record of that production that the supplier sold all of its scrap to POSCO, versus here where we have record evidence that Norsch sold all of its scrap to Capden. And finally, the decision in Nucor was based largely on the court's finding that Commerce failed to sufficiently explain, failed to go beyond simply identifying one set of prior decisions in support of its determination. Here, Commerce explained exactly how NERA's production process works and why it decided that the inputs are used exclusively by Capden as part of its overall production chain. So it went beyond simply identifying prior decisions. But in addition to that, of course, Commerce did identify ICDAS as a relevant prior decision.
So, again, looking at the Nucor decision and recognizing that it's not binding, although it certainly is persuasive, can be persuasive, the opinion says Commerce must provide a clear rationale supported by substantial evidence for the agency's determination. And picking up on the quote that was in our supplemental question and that you've also recited, it is incumbent upon Commerce to go beyond simply identifying one set of prior decisions in support of its determination. So the argument is that the analysis focused on a particular line of reasoning, but that it did not sufficiently explain how the analysis differs from other assertions of similar facts and issues. And what's your answer to that?
Well, my answer to that is we read Nucor as more, and of course, plaintiff and Your Honor may disagree, but we read Nucor as more telling Commerce to sufficiently explain why the evidence on the record of that proceeding justified its finding that there was no cross-owned input supplier, rather than asking Commerce to distinguish several prior decisions. But even so, I think on this record, Commerce did address at least some of the decisions that plaintiff is relying on. It looked at forged end blocks or fluids and blocks from Germany, noting that that review specifically disclaimed the amount of, or disclaimed the de minimis standard. And then it looked at, I think, the CTL decision as well, saying that the input wasn't sold directly to the respondent. So it did discuss those other cases. But I think the most important thing, and the thing that Commerce tries to emphasize with regard to this issue in every proceeding, is whether Commerce has sufficiently explained why the facts of that proceeding justified its decision to find cross-owned input suppliership or not. And here on pages 25 and 26 of the IDM, Commerce explained exactly why it did so for NUR and explained that entire production chain and how NUR is a link in that production chain. Moving to question two of Your Honor's supplemental questions, the Nucor opinion, what I just answered, so I won't go through that one again, just to say Commerce reasonably determined based on the facts as a whole to find NUR a cross-owned input supplier. And again, we do note that to the extent that there is a case that Your Honor should rely on, it should be ICDAS, especially since plaintiff has not established why you should depart from that case. I'll spend a little bit of time now just wrapping up regarding responses to the other parties' written answers and also some of the verbal statements that Mr. Schutz made. Just quickly, on page 8 of plaintiff's response, it states that the government of Turkey was not possibly aware that NUR makes sellable scrap. and therefore the purpose of the subsidy couldn't have been to benefit the maker of the downstream product, but it provided absolutely no evidence for the statement. It's just a conclusory statement. And if anything, the facts would show that the government of Turkey is aware because it has been a part of these countervailing duty proceedings, I think, for more than just the one administrative review. So there's every reason to think that the government of Turkey is actually aware. I think the next thing goes to page 11 of plaintiff's answers, and I think it makes a very telling statement here, and that plaintiff says, analyzing whether a lease amount paid for LPAR is different than countervailing and express exemption from rent in foreign law. In the former, the government is providing a good for less than it otherwise should, and thus the department must seek to determine what that value should have been. In the latter, the government is foregoing an express and specific amount of revenue, no either full rent or an X amount reduction in rent, and so no analysis of market value of the rent or fee is needed. And we think that is actually very illustrative. Here, the government of Turkey was providing the use of land, a good, for less than it otherwise should have been, for free. And commerce must determine what that value should have been, which is what NIR would have paid on the rental market. It is not the situation that the government of Turkey was foregoing an express amount of revenue. The agreement didn't specify a rental amount or the rent, what the rent should have been, or a deduction from the rental amount. It expressed a penalty fee that was a sliding scale depending on how close NIR got to its target amount. And plaintiff, again, hasn't established what a rental amount for that land would be or that it's anywhere in the ballpark of the amount of the penalty fee. And so you must look to the benchmarks to gauge that. And with regard to the benchmarks, Commerce can only do what it can do with the information on the record. So to the extent that plaintiff has some complaints about the Collier's report that Commerce relied on, I think there were only a couple of benchmark submissions, and Commerce decided that the Collier's was the best of what it had on the record, given that it couldn't use the amount in the agreement. Let me just look at my notes to make sure I don't have anything else. Just if Your Honor remands on the cross-owned ownership issue, I think it should also make a determination on the land for LTAR depends on whether Your Honor is remanding just for further explanation. If Your Honor is remanding for further explanation, then we, I think, agree with Mr. Schutz that it would be more efficient to make a ruling on LTAR maybe now, just because Commerce might come out the same way with further explanation. Responding to Mr. Schutz's comment that Commerce must take a holistic view, we would say that that's exactly what Commerce did here. It took a holistic view instead of using what I think Captain termed a three-step analysis process that it proposed in its brief, which is not something that Commerce has adopted. And I think that's all I have. So for these reasons, we respectfully request that this court sustain Commerce's determination. Thank you.
Thanks, counsel. Just to have a couple of questions. With respect to ICDAS in 2021, this is from this court. What is the is there any further appellate status on that case?
I'm not entirely sure. I don't know if either of the other parties know whether that's been appealed or not. Apparently not.
And with respect to the October New Court decision, what is the appellate status, if any? I know it was obviously partial remand.
My understanding is that Commerce hasn't yet filed the final remand determination. I think the draft remand redetermination may have gone out to the parties, but the parties, they haven't completed that process. And I think Commerce's final remand in that case is due at the end of this month. So I think if there's going to be an appeal, it would be pretty far away.
You heard my question regarding the existence of a as you're well aware of another Captan case, and Mr. Schutz saying, as I understood it, basically the same record? Same issues. Same issues, right? Is that your understanding?
Honestly, I'm not the attorney assigned to that case. I know it seems like it should be, but that case isn't mine, so I'm not too familiar with what the exact facts and the procedural posture of that case is.
I think Mr. Purdy wants to...
There's one additional issue in that case, and there was a round of stay briefs at the court.
Right, we're familiar with that opinion, yeah. To stay, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honor. Again, my name is Maureen Thorson. I'm from Wiley-Ryan, and here for the defendant intervener, RTAC. I'm going to switch it up a little bit and start with my rebuttal points to the general questions that the parties filed responses to last week, and then go into the supplemental questions that Your Honor issued on Friday. With respect to NERS provision of scrap to Captan, no one here disputes that Captan and NER were cross-owned or that NER provided scrap to Captan. And in similar circumstances, such as those underlying the ICDASH case, the court has upheld Commerce's cross-attribution of subsidies. While NER generated the scrap that it sold to Captan as a byproduct, this does not make that scrap irrelevant for purposes of the agency's attribution analysis. As the court noted in last year's Nucor case, Commerce has found steel scrap primarily dedicated to the production of rebar when there was no question that the input supplier generated scrap as a byproduct. And here, not only does the record show that steel scrap is an input into Captan's rebar production, Captan submitted information indicating that it is the primary input into its rebar production. And here, I'd point the court to Exhibit 2 of Captan's initial questionnaire response, which has a public production process diagram highlighting the importance of scrap. I don't believe that's in the joint appendix, so I've printed out copies of the relevant pages for the parties and the court. It's a pretty simple little diagram, but I think it gives you an idea that scrap is, in fact, an important part of Captan's production. And prior judicial precedent likewise indicates that scrap is the primary input into rebar production, and I point the court to two prior cases involving rebar administrative reviews. One of those is the Habash Sinai case. It's 625 F sub 2nd. 1339, and with a pin site to page 1348. And the court in that case noted that scrap was the single primary input into producing rebar. Similarly, in yet another Nucor case, this one at 612 F sub 2nd 1264 with a pin site to 1323, the court noted the same, that scrap is the primary input into producing rebar. This fact helps explain why cases like FEBs from Germany are not controlling here. Whatever the specific factual situations that those cases presented might have been, rebar presents its own situation, one in which scrap is the primary input. Indeed, scrap is so important to the production of rebar that Turkish rebar producers have previously analogized it to semolina's relationship with pasta production. And you'll see that in that Nucor case 612 F sub 2nd at 1324. The preamble, of course, gives the relationship between semolina and pasta as an example of a primarily dedicated input. Finally, Captan's assertion that the Turkish government could not have intended to benefit rebar production by subsidizing a shipbuilding company is both speculative, as the government has said, and irrelevant. Consider that in the proceeding underlying the ICDASH case, the input supplier was not even a company that produced steel-containing goods. Yet the court upheld cross-attribution of subsidies based on its provision of steel scrap to an affiliated downstream rebar producer. Further, as discussed in that case, the amount of scrap supplied is itself irrelevant. I'd like to move on to the benefit measurement and whether it should have been done with a revenue foregone or LTAR analysis.
Now, counsel, can I just step back for a
moment?
Yes. You have provided a very interesting analysis and distinguishing or also explaining the similarities of a prior line of approaches and determinations by Commerce. Has Commerce done that? In what's before the court now?
So
here,
I think
the question isn't so much necessarily whether Commerce could have done that, and the argument would be, well, it should be remanded to present the kind of analysis which you just presented, or whether looking at what is before the court now, the record suffices for a determination without remand.
I think the record suffices without remand, because at this point, with respect to rebar, it's like saying, does Commerce have to decide on the facts of the sky is blue every single case? Or at what point do we recognize the sky is blue? It's been blue for the last 17 administrative reviews. It's still blue. Rebar is a product that is well known to the department. I'm citing cases that this court issued over a decade ago saying scrap is the primary input into rebar production. There haven't been any sea changes in the production of rebar since then. It's a pretty well-known product with a pretty well-known process and one that Commerce has seen over and over and over again. Again, I think there's a point at which, yes, every administrative review stands on its own, but the agency isn't in the, a tabula rasa situation with every single administrative review having to look at the production process as if it had never seen it before in its life. And I do think that is relevant when you look at cases like glass containers or forged and fluid blocks. Those are the first times those products had ever been looked at. Commerce had never had a case into glass containers before or forged fluid end blocks, so it didn't have prior, investigations or long experience of the knowledge of the production process to go by.
And so, again, your home run case for the proposition that it is not necessary for Commerce to explain why or the sky is blue when that's an undisputed fact, and it's although some might dispute it, climate change or whatever, is what? What is your home run case?
My home run case?
Yeah.
I don't have a home run case. I have pure logic, and
right,
I have the
right.
fact that.
No, I'm just wondering, is there a judicial opinion that supports?
I would actually look to ICDASH. I would look to the ICDASH case, because I think what you'll see there is the court not saying, but rebar, what's rebar? We don't understand what rebar is. Why did Commerce not have a lengthy disquisition into the production process of rebar? Similarly, I think last year's Nucor Corp case is relevant because it was a steel product case. My reading of that case is that Judge Barnett found Commerce's treatment of the scrap there confusing precisely because flat-rolled steel is a primary steel, normal kind of steel product. So why would scrap be different there than it would be for something like Oil Country Tubular Goods or rebar, where the agency has repeatedly treated scrap as a primarily dedicated input? Why is it suddenly different for cold-rolled or cut-to-length steel flat products? These are pretty standard-issue steel products. What's the difference? Why are we seeing that change in how things are going? And that's one of the reasons I think that case got remanded, not simply because, there's two different types of lines of precedent here, but this is really confusing, the way you've treated scrap, given the way you've treated scrap in other cases involving analogous primary steel mill products. Moving on to the benefit measurement, Commerce reasonably measured the benefits of NERS contract with the government of Turkey using its LTAR analysis. First, that treatment makes sense because, as CAPTAN reported on the first page of its second supplemental questionnaire response, and you'll find that in the joint appendix at tab 15, the contract did not exempt NERS from paying rent. Instead, it called for CAPTAN to provide alternative forms of consideration in exchange for being allowed to use land. And crucially, this is not a situation in which the contract established a clear price term. CAPTAN characterizes the contract as an up-down agreement pursuant to which NIR would either completely fill a group of conditions and be allowed to use land without a monetary fee, or NIR would fail to meet those conditions and have to pay a fee. But this is not the case. Both the contract itself and the GOT's gloss of the contract, which NIR quotes at page 12 of its answers to the court's questions, indicate otherwise. And CAPTAN acknowledged below that where there is no clear price term in the contract, Commerce's LTAR methodology is the only way to measure benefits. And I'd point the court to that's Joint Appendix tab 21 at page 18. Thus, even if there are times in which Commerce has measured the benefits of rent exemptions using a revenue foregone methodology, that methodology is not available here. I was going to go on to the court's supplemental questions, but I see I'm out of time. So,
how many more minutes do you need?
Just a couple minutes, Your Honor. I think my answers to your supplemental questions are all very much along the same lines with each other, so I think I can handle them in a couple of minutes.
Sure. Why don't you go ahead? Because actually, there was some time left on the playing field by the Department of Justice, I think. Right.
Okay. All right. Well,
we divided up to 13.
Okay. I'll be quick because I don't want to get too far into what the government has. So, to my mind, the new court case from last year is helpful because it recognized that Commerce's treatment of scrap in the 2018 Korean CTL plate review was inconsistent with prior cases in which Commerce had treated scrap as primarily dedicated to downstream steel production, notwithstanding the fact that it's generated as a byproduct. But I also think that case, while helpful, is not necessary to a determination that Commerce acted reasonably here. Again, not only does this record show that scrap is an input into CAPTAN's rebar production, CAPTAN provided information indicating that it is the primary input, and that is consistent with prior case law and Turkish rebar producers' statements in prior cases. And with respect to why there's seemingly these sort of distinct lines of precedent, as the government has explained, in determining whether to cross-attribute subsidies provided to an input supplier, Commerce evaluates the nature of the input and the downstream products and their production processes. While I happen to disagree with the way the agency has conducted that analysis with respect to Korean flat-rolled products, it's nonetheless the case that, as the agency routinely states, not all inputs or downstream products are the same and not all production processes are the same. Therefore, you can't have a uniform one-size-fits-all approach across all cases with respect to input supplier analysis. But again, whatever the specific factual situations presented in past cases, like SEBs from Germany or Korean refrigerators may have been, rebar presents its own situation and one in which scrap has been recognized as a primary, if not the primary, input. And finally, again, I view the court in the new court case as indicating that the Korean flat-rolled cases are the ones that really appear to be outliers, or at least that it was not obvious why Commerce was treating the supply of scrap for flat-rolled production distinctly from the supply of scrap for rebar production or OCTG's production. And again, this case is not Commerce's first time at the rebar rodeo. There's prior judicial precedent going back years about the importance of scrap to rebar production, and I think this some of that as well as CAPTAN's own information demonstrates that this is a product, an input, and a downstream product for which cross-attribution makes sense. And if you have no further questions, then I will let the other parties take the field.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Schutz.
Okay. I'll just hit a couple of the rebuttal points here. First, I don't think that Commerce
you know, actually found in this case that, that scrap is only used for rebar primarily, or had really any analysis other than that, other than a reference to other cases. And while I wish it were true that you didn't have to put the same thing on the record every case and make the same arguments in every case, the fact is that that is what is required by the law. And once we make an argument about this issue, Commerce needs to support it with substantial evidence. You can't just say because we said it was primarily dedicated in another case, it's primarily dedicated in this case. There has to be something for the court to hang its hat on and review and identify whether that's
the court takes additional notice that the sky is blue.
No.
The agency takes judicial notice that the sky is blue.
No. It has to be supported by, if that's the basis of their decision, it has to be based on evidence. If that is a core issue that they are looking at, if the issue is what color is the sky, and nobody puts on any information or somebody argues that it's a different color, Commerce can't just say, well, it's blue. It has to be based on substantial evidence.
But if other determinations have agreed that the colors will, is there a need?
If there is, it depends on how fulsome the discussion is in the other case, right? Let's say that there's a discussion in another case where it's really going into the issue. Yeah, maybe that could be the basis. But if I find another case that says this guy is red, like we have here, which is you have the FEV's case, you have the case that's underlying in Nucor and glass containers, et cetera, you have these other cases that are saying scrap is not primarily dedicated to a downstream steel product. I mean, what Ms. Thorson's left out is the fact that scrap is used for every steel product. Almost. We didn't put information on the record about that if that was an issue that Commerce was interested in. But it's not just used for rebar. And I remind Your Honor that it is used for billet in this case, which is an intermediate product to rebar. And billet's also used for a million different steel products. The last thing I would say about this, and then I'll go on to other issues, is that I don't believe that there is a case where Commerce said that scrap is, or other people have said that scrap is the same as semolina, which is used for pasta. And like I said, semolina is only used for pasta. Scrap is used for a bunch of different types of steel. Going on to a couple other issues, I guess the one related to this was Ms. Bay was discussing about the provision in the preamble where whether it's related to import production or total production, and this is really the same discussion that Judge Barnett had in footnote 9 of Nucor. But I'll note that that he mentioned in that footnote, he made the same point, but he also mentioned that he wasn't saying that the primary business activity shouldn't be taken into account. It was just that you didn't really explain whether it should. And then I would point Your Honor to the example that probably causes the most problems with all of this, which is the plastics example in the preamble. And what's important about that example is that the example wasn't saying that, well, I guess back up. Commerce's view is that if the input is used for the production and the input supplier sells all the input to that producer, that could be primarily dedicated. Well, that's not what the plastics example says in the preamble. If that were true, then there wouldn't be the plastics example in the preamble. So I think that's an important point. So there has to be some way to kind of justify the semolina example and the plastic example and come up with some analysis as to how to analyze both of those issues and come up with a consistent result. The last two things I want to talk about is a couple of things about land. One is the benchmark issue. They make this point, I forget who made it, about that we're just stuck with the record and that Commerce had to use the benchmark and couldn't do anything else. That doesn't absolve Commerce from the law, which requires them to use a benchmark that is as specific as possible to the input in this case, or the good being valued in this case, the land. If I put, you know, if I didn't put anything on the record and petitioners put rent values for a penthouse in downtown Manhattan, Commerce couldn't just use that as the land rent value because that's the only thing on the record. They would have some obligation to find something else. There's lots of times where Commerce finds their own benchmarks. But we did put, as we said in our brief, ways to adjust the benchmark to account for the comparability issues. The last thing is there was this discussion about whether or not this program relates to a preferential land, whether it relates to preferential rent, as Ms. Bay quoted back to me, a statement in my response. And the way to look at this is you have to start with the law. If the law provides, or the allegation underlying the subsidy allegation alleges that this is a preferential rent program, then you're analyzing whether or not the rent is at market value. Okay? That is not what this law is. This law is not a preferential rent program. This law is an exemption from monies that you have to pay to use the land. That is always the starting point for any subsidy analysis. That's why you start with revenue foregone instead of the LTAR. Thank you. That's all I have.
Thanks, counsel. Ms. Bay?
Sure, I'll try and keep it extremely short. I think just two quick points. CAPDAN doesn't even use the scrap for steel rebar, but I think that CAPDAN itself said in its opening brief that CAPDAN did use it for steel rebar along with billet and a couple other products. Second of all, it is only required that CAPDAN use the scrap in its downstream steel production, not solely the subject merchandise. While it does matter that it used the subject merchandise at all, it is here. It's just not used necessarily solely as subject merchandise. And then my only other point has to do with Mr. Schutz's final point that you have to follow the law. And I think what's key here is, again, there is no rental term in the contract that shows what Moore would have paid if not for this agreement. And so Commerce can't simply assume that this penalty fee is what Noor would have otherwise paid, and I think that's something that you just can't escape from. Commerce has to have a way of determining what that amount would be, and here it's determined based on benchmarks. And while I don't disagree with Mr. Schutz that a penthouse in Manhattan wouldn't be comparable, that's not what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with industrial land prices in Turkey, and I think Commerce scaled it to account for regional specificity. So we're not dealing with a situation such as the one that Mr. Schutz posited. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Nothing further from me, Your Honor.
I'd like to thank all counsel for their very enlightening arguments and also for the very helpful filings. As is, you know, my custom, if any of the parties wish to file a post-argument submission of not more than 1,250 words. They can do so by close of business Tuesday, January 31st. And if you've, if any party has raised arguments, or I should say, you know, presented cases that are that haven't been presented before, this would be an opportunity to present them. So without further further delay. I know many of you have to travel. And again, it is really great to see everybody here in the courtroom. So stay safe and be well. And until next time, thank you.
All right.